Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Nolan. I'd like to welcome you to this program. This is the Progressive Commentary Hour. Each week at this time, we select a topic, generally one that is not given an objective, in-depth analysis by the mainstream media. Today's topic is the many ways our government has increased surveillance on American citizens. Our panelists to delve into this will be Chase Madar. He is a New York-based civil rights attorney, a journalist. He is a member of the National Lawyers Guild, a public interest association of lawyers dedicated to progressive change in our economic, legal, and political systems and supporting human rights over proprietary interest. He is the author of The Passion of Bradley Manning, the story of the suspect behind the largest security breach in U.S. history, which was republished as an expanded edition in March. He has also written frequently for the London Review of Books, La Mode, Tom Dispatch, The American Conservative, where he's a contributing editor, and Counterpunch. He will be joined by Hani Vakori, a staff attorney with the Electronic Frontier Foundation. He writes and speaks on issues surrounding the intersection of technology and criminal law, privacy, and free speech. He has argued before the Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals on warrantless cell tracking and has written Know Your Rights, a Legal Guide. Prior to joining Electronic Frontier, Hani worked as a federal public defender where he tried numerous cases and argued multiple times before the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals. He served as a copy editor for the 2010 edition of Defending a Federal Crime Case. He is a graduate of University of Berkeley, where he received an honors degree in history and Pacific McGeorge School of Law, where he was elected to a Order of the Barristers for his excellence in written and oral advocacy. He is a member of the National Association of Criminal Defense Lawyers and an adjunct instructor at University of California Hastings College of Law. And also we have Medea Benjamin. She is co-founder of the anti-war feminist organization Code Pink and a co-founder of the international human rights organization Global Exchange. For the past 20 years, she has been an advocate for social justice. In 2005, she was among women nominated to receive a collective Nobel Peace Prize for their efforts to promote peace. She has been at the forefront of protesting the war efforts of Bush and Obama, and her activities in the Gaza Freedom March and flotilla, and her being arrested in Pakistan for supporting silenced lawyers seeking human rights policies. In the past, she has worked as an economist and nutritionist for the United Nations and World Health Organizations, and she has diligently fought the World Trade Organization. Medea is the author of the recent book, Drone Warfare, Killing by Remote Control, which goes into detail about this stealth weaponry and its role in shaping U.S. military foreign policies in many nations around the world. I welcome our panelists to our forum. I would like for each of you, starting with you, Medea, to give an opening statement, take whatever time you wish, and then we then allow each panelist to go into great depth on a particular question I'll be asking. But all of you, I'd like your input. Medea, what is the relationship between the increase in the national security state and domestic surveillance, as well as the increase in foreign military conflicts?
Well, I have just been focusing on a particular aspect of that, and that is the issue of drones. And that's because it's something that I have been looking at overseas and recognize that the same technology is turning around to focus here at home. The Drone Association is a very powerful lobby group that has seen that it's market is shrinking with the U.S. out of Iraq and potentially in Afghanistan soon, and so has been trying to expand the use of drones here at home, and looks at the 18,000 police stations in this country and says, aha, that's a terrific market for us. And so they have done something quite extraordinary behind the backs of the American people, and that is push Congress to pass legislation to open up U.S. airspace to drones by September 2015. And this would allow for an unprecedented expansion in the surveillance of the U.S. government that would really allow for 24/7 type of surveillance. And I think this is something that the public is not aware of at all, but would build on what is already an over-spied on society and turn it into potentially a society where there is an ongoing surveillance, not only of individuals and types of people that might be of concern, but these drones are capable of being up in the air like the Global Hawk and surveilling an entire city and just downloading those images on a 24/7 basis.
Thank you. Let's go over. Chase, would you answer the same question, please?
Yes. And first, Gary, thanks so much for having me on and for that splendid Wagner introduction. I want you to know I'm never doing another radio show again unless they give me a swirling Wagner introduction like that. It doesn't have to be Ride of the Valkyries, you know, but something suitable. So war and secrecy and surveillance, they expand together, and they foster each other. It's a destructive, positive feedback loop. The more war you have, the more secrecy and surveillance you get. The more secrecy and surveillance you get, the more war you're going to have. After 9/11, we go on war footing. We go on this incredible spending spree. Unaccountable bureaucracies, this alphabet soup of national security, purportedly national security bureaucracies coming out of Washington. Dana Priest, top investigative reporter at the Washington Post, puts the price tag at $2 trillion. You've had 33 building complexes spring up in the D.C. area, 17 million square feet. And most recently in Bluffdale, Utah, you have a national security agency complex going up $2 billion, 1 million square feet, and that's under Obama, who many of us naively thought was going to slow this down. Now, the more secrecy you have, the less information you have, and the more likely you are as a public, as a nation, to make very foolish, poorly informed decisions, like, for instance, invading Iraq, or to go back in history, invading South Vietnam after the very fishy and not entirely candid Gulf of Tonkin incident that led to hysteria and a similar dynamic. So that's where we are. We need to break out of this positive feedback loop of secrecy and surveillance and war.
Thank you, Chase. Hanny, would you address this as well, please?
Sure, happy to, and also happy to be on the show. I think what we oftentimes see is in the rush to address a pressing emergency problem, we create a rubric and a system and a large-scale organization that impacts far more Americans than people had initially anticipated. And I speak, of course, you know, of the Patriot Act, which dramatically expanded the ability of the federal government to conduct surveillance in secret, with little transparency and little openness to not only the subjects being surveyed, obviously, but to the American public as a whole. And as a result, what we've seen is this growth of surveillance that's conducted secretly that the American public is unaware of. And what the real problem with that is, when we finally do as a society stop to think about what just happened, it's oftentimes too late, and that's because law enforcement, both internationally and domestically, get used to having the type of wide open access to people's communications, their emails, their thoughts, and they resist the urge of government to kind of take back what they probably shouldn't have given in the first place. And we've seen now that 11 years after 9/11, we still have the Patriot Act pretty much as it was enacted, you know, in 2001, despite the fact that we're no longer, in those kind of crazy days after 9/11. And yet we've got an apparatus still in place that's aggressively and zealously working to monitor and catalog what people are saying. And that's really what the problem is.
Thank you. Now we're going to go to more extended answers, go into great depth. There's no commercial interruptions. And unlike a lot of hosts, I really believe that we learn almost like a classroom on the air by allowing our guests to have unfettered and uninterrupted comments. So you have a chance to prepare the listener with a context for your answers. So we're going to start with you, Chase. I'm very concerned that the average American, even the more educated Americans, are not really aware of how powerful a National Defense Authorization Act is and what rights it gives the government or the president or those around them. And also, the average American, if you ask about habeas corpus, most would not know what it is. And even those who are fully aware of it, on both the left and the right, have not made this an issue. I'm concerned about that. I'd like for you to address that. Also, Obama's executive privilege to order assassination of U.S. citizens. My concern here, if you would address, please, is that in normal jurisprudence, there's an opportunity for you, if you are challenged, to look at your accuser, know who they are, prepare a defense, and make your case, hopefully before some people who at least are trying to be impartial. With this, from what I understand, a group of individuals meets in secret. They decide who should be on a kill list. They are meeting each week. The president is given this list and only given one side of this. It's not as if the people who are being targeted are allowed to have counsel there to represent their interest. How then is it that this represents any measure of what a law should represent, of fairness? I'd like for you to address that, if you would, please. Those two issues.
Okay, sure. Well, first of all, I think it's even more sinister and more alarming than the premise of your question might have it. I'm going to say something blasphemous, so come close up to the radio set because I'm going to whisper it a little bit. But I think the problem isn't so much that people don't know how extensive the government's powers of spying on us are, but that they really don't care. A few years ago, Eric Schmidt, then the CEO of Google, told an interviewer very calmly that, quote, if you have something that you don't want anyone to know, maybe you shouldn't be doing it in the first place. And that's, of course, horribly alarming coming from the CEO of Google, a company with just unparalleled powers of intrusion. But I think that this represents a fair amount of what passes for common sense in the United States today. I would love to tell you otherwise, but all our national bullcrap about us being the land of the free has never really been true. I mean, yeah, you have the writings of Madison and Jefferson, which were the cutting edge of enlightenment at the time, but at the same time you have chattel slavery and plantation slavery, which is more medieval than the Middle Ages. And, the story of American freedom has never been, it's never been such a popular thing as we might like to think. About drones, I expect that there might be some increase in transparency and even a veneer of legality papered over the drone assassinations in Obama's second term. I don't think that transparency and even legal oversight are the main issues. I think they're important, don't get me wrong, but the real issues are the moral problems of it and what bad strategy it is, as it creates even more problems and more security risks. So I expect that there will be some kind of papering over of legal procedure and legal process. How meaningful it will be, I don't know. I think many intellectuals, and we lawyers in particular, like to think that law is the solution to everything. If we have more legal process, more legal oversight, and procedure, that will all be good. But the sad fact is law is often terrible. It's as dirty as politics. And if we just look back at our own country's history, we can see in the history of white supremacy, the history of how gays and lesbians have been persecuted, how law can be really evil. So right now, opinion polls are saying that about a three-quarters majority of self-identified liberal Democrats support the drone strikes. I think with a little more information and transparency, that might go down to about half, but I still think they will be wildly popular in the U.S. and will continue unless something dramatic changes.
One follow-up question. I travel a great deal, and I always opt for the pat-down. I don't want to go through the intrusion of my body being exposed to any ionizing radiation, and they originally lied, said they were safe, and then it turns out they weren't. But now, while I was standing in line just a few days ago on my way to Washington, this woman was going through the line and just taking every single person before and behind me and taking swabs of their hands. And if you didn't agree to that, then you were suddenly taken out of line. And I asked the person, I said, since when is this going on now? And now it's a new routine. So at what point do you believe the American public will say there's enough? Or is there any limit to which you can push the American public before they adapt to it, and that becomes just a new inconvenience, but the new norm?
It's just so depressing to me how much Americans accept. I mean, we've become a disgustingly obedient people, by and large, who put up with that. We think it's maybe patriotic duty, that this is the war sacrifice we're supposed to be making, given that we certainly, by and large, except for our volunteer army and their families, we have not made sacrifices for our state of permanent war in the past 11 years. I think it's also important to note just how faulty and ridiculously flawed, even on its own terms, these airport security measures are. They're expensive. There are huge flaws in them. People are, testing the machines are constantly able to get things through it. And then you have incidences like at JFK Airport, a jet skier accidentally crashing onto the runway and just walking up to it. And then in Philadelphia earlier this year, a guy plowed his SUV through a weak fence and wound up on the runway there. I mean, it's all a joke. It's security theater. It's meaningless. And yet it is incredibly invasive, and it feels like getting groped or molested. And it really needs to stop. When it will stop, it can't come soon enough, but I don't know.
Madea, thank you for that, Chase. I'll be coming back. Madea, many people are simply not familiar with everything involving drones, and you are certainly one of the more educated people on the subject, but why don't you give us a primer? We've heard that some drones now, either prototypes or actual drones, could be as small as a hummingbird and could actually fly into or look through a person's house or apartment. We have heard that that there's over 106 governmental agencies that have requested permits to use drones. We have seen what Chase was just talking about police departments all over across the United States requesting drones. So what we have now is we have a military-industrial complex that, as long as they can keep people of the mindset that we are always under threat of a terrorist and keep us fearful, then they'll go ahead and make as many as they can because it's very profitable. And we never do the following. And maybe you could address this. We never ask how much does a drone actually cost. Not the way they price it, cost plus. But if you were to build a drone and compare it to one of the military-industrial complex people, how much would it actually cost? Because there's massive profiteering in all these weapon systems. Secondly, talk the difference between a reconnaissance drone versus an armed drone. Then, if you could, as much as you have available, we've been told that these are surgically precise efforts, meaning they can take out a car, and we saw what they did in Gaza by the taking out that one Hamas leader's car. But then what we don't see is how many drones take out whole buildings or miss their mark or kill all these innocent people. and we have at least 1,000 people throughout the different countries where drones have been used that have been victims. Why is there no embedded journalists that have asked the president, at any time that I've heard at least, why don't you take responsibility for each one of the citizens you kill and then ask yourself, knowing that any enemy that you kill, any enemy, will be replaced almost immediately with an unlimited amount of people, just like drones coming off clones coming off of the assembly line. You kill one high-ranking Al-Qaeda, there'll be five to take their place. You kill five, there'll be 20 to take their place. As if the idea is if they kill one person with a drone, it's game over. And it's never game over. And yet they continue to do this. Could you take a step-by-step through this whole area of drones, please?
Well, that's a lot of things together. In terms of the size of the drones, yes, they can be the size of an insect. There's a dragonfly drone. There's hummingbird drones. There's drones that are mimicking all different kinds of bugs and birds in nature. And those are surveillance drones that are being tested out in places in the outside the U.S. and tested in inside the U.S. through dozens of universities that have now depend in their engineering departments on grants from the Defense Department in order to function. So they have roped in a lot of the best young minds in this country into the development of this vast array of nano drones, micro drones, to the big global hawk that's the size of a commercial airplane. The cost of the drones, of course, depends on what drone you're talking about. They're the drone that you can get on Amazon for $300. And then there's the Global Hawk that costs $170, sometimes $200 million. The ones that the police departments are getting, Gary, one of the really disgusting things is that most police departments around the country are seeing their budget cut. And so the Homeland Security is coming in and saying, aha, we'll give you a grant of several $100,000 to buy these drones and, of course, get these police department hooked. Now they say, oh, well, this is so much cheaper than a helicopter, but only about 2% of police departments have helicopters. But now they all want drones. It would be great to see some investigative journalism looking at the three dozen police departments that have already received FAA licenses to test out the drones and see just how cost effective they are. I would venture a guess to say not at all, that they're just a silly toy so far that the police departments have, and yet they can be used for all kinds of invasive activities. They can be equipped with facial recognition features, with laser radar, with license plate readers, with thermal imaging devices. In the future, they can add biometric recognition, so they could track individuals based on things like height, age, gender, skin color, and soon supposed to have the capacity to actually see through walls and ceilings. In terms of how they're being used overseas and are they precise, of course not. We're being lied to by our government agencies, from President Obama to counterterrorism chief John Brennan to members of Congress who barely deign to talk about it. But when they do, they say, rest assured, this is only getting the bad guys. In the meantime, for the last 10 years, we've been using these drones overseas to kill people. And the government says, well, anybody who's a male of military age and lives in the place where we're using these drones is automatically a militant. So the government just says 10 militants killed here, 15 militants killed there, and the American people nod, say, aha, isn't this great? We're being protected from these evildoers who want to do us harm. In the meantime, we're killing all sorts of innocent people who then their family members become militants and say, well, the only way to get justice is to pick up a gun and try to cross over into Afghanistan and kill an American. So we are creating more enemies faster than we're killing them, and all this does is feed the industry that is making these weapons and keeps the Americans in a perpetual state of fear to justify the national security state that we have here at home.
A follow-up question. I've just completed filming a major documentary called Poverty Inc., which we spent years traveling throughout the country, I did, interviewing thousands of the new poor in America. I find it rather ironic that we have 18 million children each day in the United States who are food insecure. They just don't have enough food. And we have 47.1 million Americans currently on food stamps, one-third of the entire American population. The entire population, over 100 million people, are now at the base level of being considered impoverished to extreme impoverished. So on the one hand, we have unlimited amounts of money for drones and other warfare and unlimited billions to our supporters like Israel in the Middle East or other countries, but we can't find money for what is important here at home, whether it's infrastructure or helping people. Do you ever look at any of this in your work and your research and say, should the American public refocus its priorities?
Well, of course, in fact, we were out in front of the White House last week with a big inflated Pentagon showing how much money we were spending on the wars overseas, on the 800-plus military bases we still have around the world, on money to countries that are abusing other people's rights, like the $3 billion we give to Israel, and comparing it to the needs that we have here at home, and then deflating the Pentagon to a sustainable size. Right now, we spend 56% of our discretionary funds on the Pentagon, and as Congress and the president talk about this, quote, fiscal cliff, they pretend that they're actually talking about significant cuts to the Pentagon, but nothing could be further than the truth. They're talking about not continuing to increase the Pentagon budget. But if you add up what goes into the Pentagon and then the hidden costs of the Pentagon, like in the Energy Department for nuclear weapons and other things, it's about a $1 trillion budget. We could cut the Pentagon by 80% and still have the largest military by far in the world, and we would be safer at home because we wouldn't be making so many enemies overseas, and we would be safer at home because we could invest that money in the things that people really need to make their lives more sustainable and to make this the planet more sustainable.
I appreciate those answers. Let us now go over to Hanny. Would you give us your particular take on what it means today to be an American who wishes to speak on an issue and become, in effect, an activist, either by signing petitions or showing up and demonstrating, knowing full well that almost all demonstrations in the United States, if they're against a corporate entity or the government policies, you could end up on a watch list. You could end up being monitored. Now, we know this for a fact because we found this out from Freedom Information Act, including the Occupy movement had infiltrators and, we believe, provocateurs. And yet we go back to Martin Luther King and we see that virtually all the social demonstrations during the period of the Vietnam War, as later would become evident under the Church hearings under Senator Church and Operation COINTELPRO and MK Ultra, all of these had one thing in common. Anyone who protested using their freedom of speech was considered an enemy of the state, and the files were kept at that time mainly by the FBI. Now today it could be any one of 16 federal agencies because there's no one accountable. What does it mean today to be able to exercise our freedom of speech when the cost of that is ending up possibly on an enemies list or worse, let's say Chris Hedges, who could end up not just on an enemies list, but because he is so strong in his point of view and so convincing, he may be considered a threat to the political stability of a given party or a given position. Could you share your insights on that? What it means to be an activist, what it means to be a citizen, and our rights being challenged without us even knowing it in most cases. The forum is yours.
Thank you again. the question is really interesting because I think what it means today is definitely you will have a significant risk of having monitoring of your communications and who you communicate with in a way that's, I think, unprecedented and easier than it ever was compared to the prior examples you mentioned. It's no longer necessary for law enforcement agencies to do anything coercive, even, to have a COINTELPRO type program. All they have to do is monitor social media accounts. All they have to do is go to companies who store data about particular people and piece all of those pieces together, which is remarkably easy in the era of technological advancement that we live in. I'll give you a great example, specifically about the Occupy movement. In New York City, in October of 2011, there was a large Occupy Wall Street protest on the Brooklyn Bridge. And as a result of that protest, over 700 people were arrested. And naturally, as in many political protests, they were arrested for the pretty trivial crime of disorderly conduct, meaning just blocking traffic on a pretty busy stretch of street and not, you know, resisting when told to leave and ultimately being dragged to jail and having to be arrested. In New York State, the crime of disorderly conduct carries a maximum punishment of 15 days in jail or a maximum fine of $250. And what the New York City prosecutors decided to do for one particular individual, Malcolm Harris, was to use that arrest and go to Twitter and request through a subpoena, not a search warrant, but a subpoena, request that Twitter turn over all of its records and any information they had about Mr. Harris and his tweeting activity in the period, in the 3 month period leading up to and after the actual protest on the bridge. Now, Mr. Harris was one protester on this bridge, and he was a person who used Twitter very aggressively and had a lot of followers, was clearly a Occupy Wall Street sympathizer, and had tweeted about Occupy Wall Street many times. And what the government was able to achieve by getting these records with a subpoena, and there were legal challenges to whether they should have to get a search warrant to get the information, which included the actual tweets and also included information like the specific IP address, which he logged in with to post a message on Twitter, which could reveal his particular location at the time he tweeted a particular message. What the government was able to achieve was not only to obtain all the information about Harris, but also to obtain all the information about anyone who Harris associated with, anyone he tweeted to, anyone he communicated with, the people he followed, the people who followed him. And as a result of one simple act of civil disobedience, which would have otherwise been treated pretty minorly, this entire kind of mapping of a group of people based solely on their political affiliations was able to be obtained by local prosecutors. And so that's unfortunately a bit of what it means to be an activist in the modern technological era we live in, where law enforcement can obtain information and records so quickly from companies and not have to even engage in the kind of aggressive, covert surveillance that they used to engage in the past.
I've written over 300 original investigative reporting articles, 58 of which of those have been cover stories for major magazine. There was a time in the 1970s when I was writing these articles when my publisher sat with me and said, do these on a typewriter. Don't talk about any of this over the telephone. These were highly sensitive. For example, I wrote the first article on the illegal exposure of the American public to biological agents. And by our Defense Department, for example, they were feeding children in hospitals radiation on toast just to see what it would do to their kidneys. And later, the Department of Defense would acknowledge that, and the Pentagon acknowledged over 1,900 such experiments. But in October of that year, I exposed that. And I remember at the time thinking, wow, how am I going to get around not talking with my sources on the phone? I have to literally go to a person every time I want to, and I have to be careful. Today, when you look at all the investigative journalists and all the important stories that are being written for Harper's, Atlantic Monthly, and Mother Jones and other publications, virtually all those writers are going to be watched. All of their sources are watched because they all impact either government or corporate interest. If Matt Taibbi thinks that he's not being monitored, then he'd be kidding himself. So on the one hand, we are supposedly encouraging people, including whistleblowers, to tell the truth. On the other hand, this administration, this president, has been more vigorous going after whistleblowers and has gone after more whistleblowers in his Justice Department and Eric Holder than any and all other presidents combined in American history. So what does that tell us about where we really stand with the ability to come forward with information that the American public has in some way been harmed or lied to or manipulated against its interest, and having that information be able to get to the public without the person bringing it being considered a threat to the national security or corporate interest, and therefore being silenced, harassed, or set up in some way? I'd like your thoughts on this.
Well, we definitely are living in an age in which transparency and attempts to, you know, blow the whistle are going to be met with alarming and increasing repercussions at a level that hasn't really been seen before by our government. And ultimately, the big problem with that is it leaves people in the dark about what's actually going on. And then I think what that ultimately does is it leaves people to not care. And it becomes, when an issue blows up and people realize what's happened, it's oftentimes too late. And so, you know, I am extremely worried and have been disappointed in President Obama's policies with respect to the Department of Justice's very aggressive use of criminal law to go after whistleblowers. I've been extremely disappointed at the government's lack of transparency about how they use surveillance technologies, you know, like wiretap, like cell phone tracking records, like devices that basically act as fake cell phone towers in which the government can suck down records of which specific phone numbers connect to which specific phone towers at particular times and reveal a person's location. And, you know, attempts to create transparency are met with resistance by both the government, by the Department of Justice. And if you try to then flip the reporting requirement to the companies that store a lot of electronic data and evidence, it's met with resistance because they don't want to pay to do all the reporting. And then as a result, what happens is nothing gets reported, nothing gets done, and nobody knows what's going on, and it continues in secret. And that's really not the type of society I want to live in, and I think it's not the type of society the majority of the listeners want to live in, but unfortunately, to a certain extent, that is the society we live in unless we do something about it to change it.
I have one follow-up question for you on that. Since on the one hand, we're constantly told that we are a nation of laws and that you and I and the other panelists must abide by those laws or suffer the consequences, and yet, was it not the case that the telecommunications companies, including Verizon, the major sponsor of the last Democratic convention, and other major telecoms, worked illegally to obtain records without a warrantless, without the searching people's telecommunications, and then had a law enacted that Obama supported to get them out of the get them out of a legally tenuous position. Yet nothing is ever done for any of us if we should break a law. We can't get someone to go in and create a law that then goes back and grandfathers in all of our previous crimes. Could you discuss this whole idea, and how many times have we discovered, or someone discovered, evidence that's credible that the government has been breaking the law, but doing so with impunity?
Well, to answer your second question first, you know, I can't give you a number, but what I can say is it's alarming at just how much the government attempts to get away with without justifying their actions. Again, I'll give you a great example of this. There's a case in Arizona where law enforcement asked the judge to allow them to basically get certain records of a person's of an air card, basically a device that you put into a laptop that gives you an internet connection wherever you are, even if you don't necessarily have a wireless signal. It works through the cell phone network. And they wanted to get access to this card so that they could figure out where this person was using his computer at a particular time. And the judge said, okay, sure, I'm going to give you authorization to go to Verizon and, you know, have them help you locate this air card. But what the government decided to do instead was, instead of go to Verizon and do this, they decided to use a device called a Stingray, which acts as a fake cell phone tower and basically allows the government to pretend to be a legitimate cell phone tower and suck up all of the devices in a particular area that are going to connect to it. And through that use of that device, they were able to figure out where the person they were looking for was located. Now, the problem was they never even told the judge that this is the device that they were planning on using. They never told the judge that the authorization they were trying to get was for the government to do something rather than for Verizon to disclose records. And yet, now when it gets challenged, they argue in court that they had authorization in this order, even though, again, the order doesn't actually authorize the government to do anything but go to Verizon. It doesn't, you know, the order did not authorize the government to use the Stingray device. And so I think this is an example of how the government acts with impunity at times. When you mentioned the telcos getting immunity for the warrantless wiretapping that occurred under the Bush administration, I think that's an example of what I, you know, in my introductory remarks about how, you know, out of the Patriot Act, out of, you know, the kind of war paranoia that, you know, our country had in the days after 9/11, Congress allowed this type of surveillance to go unchecked and to go secretly.
Hello? I think we lost him. We'll call him. We had a disconnect there. We'll call him right back. Chase, I'm coming back to you with a large issue. It has several pieces, and yet they are connected. And here's my concern. On the one hand, we have the official corporate Democrats, and then we have the official corporate Republicans. The Democrats tell us we are against the government intrusion into our constitutional rights, and such as the loss of habeas corpus, and the invasion of our private space, and the invasion against our freedom of speech. On the other hand, we have those on the corporate Republicans and conservatives who say, we value our constitutional rights and our liberties and our Bill of Rights very high up. And yet both of them have acquiesced on this issue. I don't see Sean Hannity. I don't see Mark Levin. I don't see any of these major talking heads or ideologues on the left or right. I don't see Rachel Maddow. I don't see, you know, Lawrence O'Donnell out there putting themselves in harm's way. Now, Medea has put herself in harm's way. She has been arrested many times. Why don't these people put themselves in harm's way? Why don't they get their large congregations, if they really are opposed to something, why don't they have a demonstration in front of the White House where they're there? They're leading it and saying, we are opposed to the loss of our rights and the fact that if we're demonstrating here today peacefully and legally, we should not be targeted. We should not be photographed. We should not have, you know, an iris scan or something. And yet I never see any of these people on the corporate left or the corporate right putting themselves in harm's way to make a point, though I do see those individuals who are the more traditional liberal activist and the traditional conservative activist who do so, and they're both immediately marginalized and thrown under the bus. In the middle of all this is the American public, who watches all this as if this is a virtual reality game to amuse them, to distract them, and taking no responsibility for their problems. And yet, if you look at who's really behind the military-industrial spy complex, the intelligence complex, it would be what they would consider the 1%. So if you wanted to challenge the 1%, why don't you ask questions? Why don't you engage? Why do you can intentionally stay ignorant on the issue? Could you address these, please?
Let's start looking at both political parties and their relationship with the enormous and unaccountable national security state. The answer to the first part of your question. Now, take the Republicans. They love to blame government for everything. Government can't do anything, right? They hate government. And yet, you will not find anyone who's more in love and enthralled to the authority of the state than the mainstream of the Republican Party, who loves big government when it comes to making war and loves big government when it comes to expanding police powers. What gives here? You know, and you do have honorable exceptions like the Ron Paul crowd. I really disagree with him on many things. But I agree with him passionately on many civil liberties and foreign policy and national security issues. What about the Tea Party? They came in saying that they were going to roll back government. They're all about freedom. They love to quote Madison and Jefferson. And yet they voted overwhelmingly, the Tea Party freshmen, to renew the Patriot Act. Really depressing. And, you know, maybe it's just my soft bigotry of low expectations. I don't, you know, expect much out of the Republican Party, but I think people should hold them to account on their own rhetoric of freedom and small and limited government, constitutional government. Now the Democrats, so they talk a great game about civil liberties and limited government and limits on spying, but only when they're in the opposition. Only when they do not have the executive branch. Democrats only rise to the occasion and trim back the encroaching national security state apparatus under very specific political weather conditions. Now, you've alluded to the church committee hearings in the Senate in the mid-70s. Great moment in the history of Washington and our government. When Democrats were very mobilized, very energized in the House and in the Senate, and really fueled by backlash against Vietnam and against Watergate. But a lot of that petered out once Carter took the Oval Office. There was a lot of interest lost. And we, you know, like many people, I was hoping that would trim back all the horrible encroachments of the Bush-Cheney national security apparatus. But instead, as soon as they got power, they just normalized it. A veneer of legality here, you know, some modifications to the military tribunals in Guantanamo, there's some real limits on torture. But still, just renewing the Patriot Act and all these other horrible things. About half the Democrats are against this, but the half that really has power within the parties is all for it. The Dianne Feinsteins and you know, the Hillary Clintons, the Barack Obama as well. How do we break this? I would love to see some cooperation between the libertarian left, the libertarian right. I think Medea Benjamin is someone who's really doing this in practice, and I think Hanif Faghouri's organization, the Electronic Frontier Foundation, is good at being straight and down the line libertarian and being able to communicate clearly with both liberals and traditionalist conservatives. So I applaud both of them for trying to, you know, get a real civil libertarian movement that is both left wing and right wing.
I appreciate that insight. Medea, you have been arrested. You have been targeted. Members of your group have. People you've affiliated with, even sympathetic supporters and activists, have also been brought into that net. Tell us on a very personal level, what is it like to know that virtually everything you do, every phone call, every email, is going to be monitored, and that at a certain time, if things get so bad at a national level, if the government feels so threatened, if we start to have a Greece or a Spain happening in the United States, meaning last week there were 5 million people in Spain who went on strike, you wouldn't have known it from the American press because of the erosion of their economic base. They couldn't support themselves with these austerity moves. But now even in Spain and in Greece, any of the leading activists, the union leaders and the business leaders who are saying, we've had enough, stop giving all the money back, now they're on target list. This surveillance state that we created is now doubling down on them. And at some point, if it happens in the United States where we finally awaken and realize what we become, a fascist police state, then you and even all three of you, Chase and Hanny, you can bet that you're going to be targeted for whatever recriminations they feel they can get away with. Tell us your personal story of what this has meant to you.
Well, I benefit from something called white privilege in that I can do a lot more than my sisters and brothers who are not white can do. And I'm keenly aware of this and take advantage of it. And yet, with all that white privilege, I am on a national FBI database that, because of getting arrested for issues like trying to preserve freedoms in the United States and end baseless wars, I am not able to go into Canada. I have been stopped 3 times, and the last 3 times I've tried to get into Canada, and they say, yes, they are sharing the FBI database with Canada, and therefore anybody on the list cannot travel into their country. That is unfortunately the harbinger of things to come because of the sharing of this information. And this is information includes misdemeanors. It includes violations that in Canadian law would be considered traffic violations. So on that level, it's very disturbing. But I must say that I think it's important to have people be aware of the intrusion of the national security state. And yet as an activist, I'm conflicted because I want to get people active and involved, and I don't want to scare them. I don't want them to think that if they go out on a demonstration and they get arrested, that their lives will be much the worse for it. And so there is a fine line between that kind of education and awareness building and yet the need to motivate people and want them to get out on the streets. We know that our group has been infiltrated over the years. We know that some of our local organizations in different states, like in Maryland, have been infiltrated. And yes, we know that whatever we are planning, we should assume that somebody is listening to it, and that whatever secrets we have are not secret. And that's the way that we move forward, is in a way, understanding that we're going to be, we are being monitored. But I do think, as I said, it's important to, force people to, despite the problems, to get out on the streets, to be in opposition, whether it's a Republican or a Democrat. And I must second what you said about how difficult it is to get people who would be up in arms about things that are going on in this administration. They would have been with us if it were Bush, but they're nowhere to be seen under Obama, and I hope that in this second administration of Obama, we might be able to get some of them back with us.
I would hope so. Keith Olbermann used to offer some of the finest commentaries about once a month when it was about Bush, but none of that happened when it was about Obama. My final question of our program today, Hanny, is back to you. Why do you believe, or do you believe, that the American media has been remiss in doing its job of holding the government and corporate America, especially the military-industrial spy complex, to standards of accountability and legality? It has given it a pass after pass, from my observation, with a few exceptions. Your thoughts on that, please.
I definitely think there's not enough reporting and not enough real in-depth reporting on just the extent to which surveillance laws have gone and been expanded in the last 10, 11 years. I think the Petraeus thing is a great example of this. When the Petraeus thing broke last weekend, or 2 weekends ago rather, it was the first time in a long time that people were starting to think about email privacy. Although it's an issue that's been here for a long time, but it took this massive, dramatic crazy, ridiculous, if you will, kind of tabloid-esque scandal to get anybody to actually pay any attention to the issue. And if that's what it's going to take, that type of story to get people to care about, or to get the media, rather, to care about privacy and the growing surveillance and how technology enables that type of surveillance, we're going to have some real problems. And we're not going to have the kind of frank discussions and the frank, you know, discourse on these very important issues that we need to have in order to really see positive change in how our laws are written and how the courts interpret them.
Thank you very much. Hani Fakhouri, a staff attorney with the Electronic Frontier Foundation and author of Defending a Federal Crime and also Know Your Rights. Chase Madar, civil rights attorney and member of the National Lawyers Guild and author of The Passion of Bradley Manning, The Story of a Suspect Behind the Largest Security Breach in U.S. History, and a writer for Counterpunch, and Medea Benjamin, the author of Drone Warfare, Killing by Remote Control. Thank you all very much for sharing your insights with us on the many ways government has increased surveillance of American citizens. I'm Gary Nall. Thank you all for listening to the Progressive Commentary Hour.